Hey friends, you are listening to Currents and Religion, a podcast brought to you by the Department of Religion at Baylor University and by Baylor University Press. I'm Zen Hess. Thanks for listening today. This episode is about applying to PhD programs in religion. If you're applying right now, or thinking about taking the leap, this episode is for you. I remember the moment that I decided to apply to PhD programs. I was sitting at a coffee shop with Kent, one of my best friends and mentors. After listening to me talk myself into and out of applying for a while, he stopped me. He said something like, "It seems like you'd regret not applying more than applying and getting rejected." I went home from that conversation and sat down to make a plan to apply. It was December 2019. I looked at several departments' websites. I learned what their applications required. I set deadlines for when I would take the GRE, when I needed to draft a writing sample, and when I needed to contact potential references. I made a year-long plan that I planned to start in January of 2020. I was working full-time as a pastor for a small congregation, so I did most of my work in the evenings. I reached out to professors of interest and got confirmation that they'd be willing to work with me. I started studying for the GRE, but things started going wild pretty quickly. I scheduled my GRE for mid-March. COVID came. It got canceled. I realized I didn't know what a statement of purpose was or how to write it, and I stumbled into the dark, despairing corner of the internet called the Grad Cafe. I couldn't decide if I wanted to study New Testament or theology, so I tried writing a writing sample that fit both sorts of departments. By the fall, some departments started announcing that they were, rightly, cutting the number of new students they'd take in to make sure they had the resources needed to support their current students. One school didn't announce that at all, so that the first email I received regarding an application was sent to let me know that no students at all would be accepted and that they were refunding my application fees. I was a mess. What was most helpful to me during that time, besides, of course, the support from my wife and my friends, was people like Kent, Julie, Dustin, TJ, Ross, and Lucinda, who had done this before, who were insiders at departments, who could share what they'd done and what they'd do differently. They gave me insight on how to write application materials like the statement of purpose and how unpredictable the admissions process can be. So in today's episode, I'm speaking with people from inside Baylor's graduate program in religion. You'll hear from my friends and colleagues, Laney and Tyler, and from one of our graduate faculty, Dr. Cardoza Orlandi. Together, they offer tons of insight on how to write a good application and how to survive the application process. Enjoy. Before we get to our conversations, let's start with some nuts and bolts. I asked Candace Williams, the academic and student support associate of the graduate program in religion here at Baylor, about the steps an application goes through. So, for a graduate application sent to Baylor's religion department, this is what happens. When you apply to Baylor, you'll indicate what area of our department you're applying for. The areas are Old Testament, New Testament, historical studies, which includes world or global Christianity, and theological studies, which also includes ethics. Your application will be read by all the graduate faculty in your area of interest. Our deadline for applications is December 15. Faculty read the applications over the winter break, and then each area sends a list of four semifinalists to Candace sometime early in January. She'll reach out to semifinalists to invite them to Baylor's preview weekend. Other applicants will be notified about whether they had been placed on the waitlist or are no longer being considered. In mid-February, we bring the semifinalists to campus for a weekend of interviews with faculty hangouts with graduate students, and tours of campus. Shortly after the preview weekend, two applicants from each area will be offered spots in our program. So that's 8 students total, 2 for each area. And after that, the timeline is a little less straightforward because those who are offered spots need to hear from other schools and discern whether Baylor is the right fit for them. So that's the process. Now I want to give you a chance to hear from 2 students who are currently in our program. Enjoy these conversations. Tyler Fulcher, thanks for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
So introduce yourself to our listeners.
Yeah, so like I said, my name is Tyler. So I'm a 4th-year student in Baylor Religion Department, focusing on the Old Testament. My research is actually on mothers and children in 1 and 2 Kings. And
okay.
So I'm in the research stage of the dissertation process and really enjoying it.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Where did you come from before Baylor?
Yes.
What were you doing?
So so as far as like educational background, I started at a denominational school. I'm a part of the Assemblies of God. And so there's a small Bible college in Springfield, Missouri that I was a part of. Studied biblical languages there, which thoroughly enjoyed. Just because of the random selection of teachers, took Hebrew first and fell in love with Hebrew and the Old Testament. And from that, decided I wanted to eventually pursue academia, and ended up going to Duke, doing an MTS there.
Cool.
And then from there, eventually got into Baylor.
Same. Nice. Yeah. So, okay, tell us what you can remember about the application process.
Yeah.
Your experience of it, I should
yeah,
say.
Yeah, yeah. So I have perhaps a bit of a different experience than a lot of people. So I actually went through 2 different cycles.
Okay.
So the first year when I was done finishing up my MTS, which is a 2-year program at Duke, in that second year, I was also applying for programs and managed to get invited to the interview weekend at Baylor. That experience. And then I went home and found out that I made the wait list. So I didn't get accepted straight in, but I got the wait list and then I had to wait for a couple of months as that process played out, as people were deciding where to go. And I actually came down to the last day.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Right before the deadline when people had to decide that I got the call or the email. Actually, a couple of days before, I got an email that said, "Hey, are you still interested? We still haven't heard from the person that's in front of you on the list. If you're just, you know, hold on." And so it sort of got my hopes up.
Yeah.
And then I found out like the day before the deadline that the person accepted. So I did not get in anywhere.
Gosh, yeah, that's so hard. So much waiting.
Yeah. So it was a tough process, which led to like a really interesting year. I was done with the program. But I really wanted to do this. I really wanted to study the Bible academically and pursue that career. So I figured I would give it one more shot. So fortunately, I was actually able in that year to spend the year being a teaching assistant at Duke Divinity School, which was just a wonderful experience, helping out with the Hebrew classes and some of the Old Testament stuff. And so it was a really great experience, continued to build some relationships. And then decided to apply to several schools again. And I wasn't sure what to do about Baylor because I didn't get in. But I was like, well, I did get waitlisted, so maybe they do like me. So I threw my application out again. I got invited again to the interview weekend and then got accepted straight away. So I didn't have to wait on the waitlist.
Awesome.
Second time. Yeah.
Great. Resilience is a big part of the academic game anyway, as we were just talking about before. But I'm curious, beyond just having kind of the desire to be in academia, that year in between, you said you were a teaching assistant, that of course had to have factored into kind of the strength of your application the second year. Were there other changes that you were able to make to your application specifically that you think also helped secure you a spot?
Yeah, I mean, I think so. I think a couple of simple things. Well, first off, that year was really tough to begin with, because you're dealing with the rejection and, like, you know, I'd invested all this time and student loans into this process, and was like, well, what am I going to do now?
Yeah.
So that was a pretty emotional time. But looking back, like, not only did the teaching assistant positions that I have that went on my CV, which was really helpful.
Yeah, it's huge.
I also realized it was probably, particularly in my situation, because I had two small children, I was married, I was working other jobs. I was probably overly ambitious to apply while also in the program.
Sure.
I probably should have given it a year, but I was impatient.
Yeah.
So another year probably would have given me more time, because I was trying to, like, do coursework and also focus on this application.
Mm-hmm.
So that was definitely difficult. So the second time around, obviously I had a lot more time. It was my sole focus. So I managed to, then I had finished my master's thesis. And mm-hmm. so it was a much better writing sample, because I really, you know, had a professor at Duke who really worked with me on that. And so I was really proud of that second writing sample, whereas the first one was fine, but not as good as it could have been.
Right.
So that was a big improvement, was just my writing sample. And then the first time around, I had an idea for the type of dissertation project.
Mm-hmm.
And that's always, you know, you're supposed to come in with some idea.
Yeah.
But then they also tell you, like, but it's okay. I did not have a good idea. And the reason it wasn't a good idea was that it wasn't at all tailored to the people that I could potentially be working with.
Sure.
And so it was an idea that I was interested in,
mm-hmm.
but I hadn't really fleshed it out.
Yeah.
And then also it just didn't really make sense. I tried to connect it, but it clearly didn't make sense. So the second time around, I had given some serious thought to the strengths of the department, and I had given some serious thought to the type of project I might mm-hmm. want to work on. So I came up with a pretty fleshed out idea of what it could be. Obviously, you know, very preliminary. But that was really, really helpful, I think. And the type of response that they gave me during the interview weekend mm-hmm. to my idea was much better.
Yeah.
And one of the professors even said, like, I could see that you've grown in this last year.
Yeah.
Just from that. And I think also the second part of that was I didn't do much reach out to professors before the application process.
Okay.
So I went in pretty unknown or completely unknown.
Right.
And the second time around, I think something that definitely helped was the fact that they had a weekend talking mm-hmm. to me. And, you know, all of my social interactions with them from that first cycle were was positive.
Right.
But they didn't know me, and my, you know, my ability to communicate what I wanted to do wasn't sufficient.
Mm-hmm.
So I think the second time around, they knew me much better.
Yeah.
And then I was able to articulate more what I wanted to do. And I think those were probably the biggest factors that I can think of.
Got it. Man, that's a bunch of helpful stuff, though. I'm hearing you say a few different things. So one of the things was, your writing sample, you worked closely with someone else other than yourself,
mm-hmm.
To identify what needed to be resolved there to improve that particular essay, to make it a mm-hmm. stronger sample of what you could do.
Mm-hmm.
You gained clarity on your project, but also clarity for how it related to the department that you were applying to. So mm-hmm. more tailored, more specific to each department. And then, I mean, all of that sounds like it's contributing to some degree, especially for someone coming around a second time.
Mm-hmm.
If you can't demonstrate that you have grown over the last year, that's probably going to be a red flag for a department. And you were able to demonstrate through those two things that you'd grown, especially it sounds like the project that you're putting forward. And then the last one was some kind of connection with mm-hmm. faculty in the department that you're applying to. You said you hadn't done that before. So yeah, I guess it would be good for folks, especially in their first round, to find ways to reach out and to make initial communication with some of the folks that they'd like to work with.
Yeah, and I'd say one more thing about the project. What's funny is it has absolutely nothing to do with what I'm actually doing. It actually goes back to my master's thesis, the project that I'm actually working on. And so I proposed something on Psalms, and I'm working on 1 and 2 Kings. So it's completely unrelated.
Right.
But I think it was the ability to articulate a research project in general that they were looking for more than anything.
Right.
Because obviously, as you go through coursework, you're going to learn a lot more, and you might come across some other topics.
Right.
And so I think it would be important. I think knowing how to articulate a potential research project is really important, but not getting hung up on it being the project is also important.
That's awesome. Any words of encouragement or support for folks who are going into the application cycle this season?
Yeah. So I'd say, you know, perseverance is important. Just the whole field of academia is, it's tough.
Yeah.
Like you're going to submit your work for critique. You're submitting, you know, yourself in the application process. And that was really hard. And I wish I had done a better job of like heeding some advice from a professor at Duke who just told me, especially on that first cycle, is like, you know, there are only so many positions and there are always more qualified applicants.
Right.
It's like out of any applicant pool, there will always be, you know, 5 to 8 like that are qualified and could potentially do the work. And he said, but there's not 5 to 8 positions, you know? And so I think I probably put a little too much emotional investment on what that first process and cycle meant for me as like a person. And that's just not helpful.
Yeah, The rejections don't necessarily actually reflect anything about your competence or you as a person. They're just a reality in a competitive field. Yeah.
Yeah. Especially if, you know, trying to get into a funded program.
Yeah.
You know, that's a really difficult thing.
Yeah.
But it's worth it. That'd be basically it. And I would say be patient too. Like if you really want to do this, if you're, you know, hustling to try and get an application in, that's probably not the wisest thing.
Sure.
You probably want to have more time to be able to get it in and really work on it.
Good. Tyler, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Lainey, thank you for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Thanks for having me.
So why don't you introduce yourself to our listeners?
Yeah, hi, I'm Lainey. I'm a first year PhD student here at Baylor in the New Testament department. I just moved here from Chicago, Illinois, where I've lived for the last 10 years doing undergrad at Wheaton College. And then I got my Master's of Divinity at Trinity Evangelical Divinity School.
So you're just a Chicagoan at this point, right?
I would call it home. I do hail originally from Dallas, Texas, so it's fun to be back in my home state.
Love it. We're glad to have you here. So, and tell us just a little bit about what kind of aspect of New Testament studies led you to feel like you should apply and come do a PhD.
Yeah, I wasn't initially, when I started my master's program, interested in getting a PhD, but through the encouragement of some professors and once I got the chance to teach Greek at my divinity school, I really fell in love with Greek and teaching and studying the Gospels and literary criticism and then just kept moving forward for the PhD process. And here I am now.
Awesome. And tell us a little bit about your experience of the application process.
Yeah, it's fun to be on the other side of it a whole year later. It is a stressful and difficult process just because there are so many unknowns and most people are applying when they're working full time or in a program full time. So it's a lot to juggle. I was a full time student teaching and doing the GRE and the whole process. But I think just recognizing that it will be like a part time job and spacing out your hours to devote to it is really helpful to keep in mind, to have a mentor or deadlines or students that are also doing it alongside with you just to hold you accountable in some way, shape, or form is also really helpful. And then just having like a research topic and proposal that interests you and keeps you going and that helps you see that the end goal is worth it, all the struggle during the process.
And so the research topic bit, did you come up with that in a class that you were in, or how did you kind of land on a topic?
Yeah, I was doing an independent study on the Gospels or the Synoptics and Acts during that fall semester that I was applying. Mm-hmm. And so I was planning for that research paper for that class to work for my writing sample. How did I land on a topic? I picked a gospel that I loved, yeah. Luke. And I just started noticing patterns, incorporated some of the literary elements into it. And also I found something that was really shocking and struck me and made me feel uncomfortable, which is Jesus's anti-family statements and like mm-hmm. how people often excuse them or like dismiss them as yeah. like, oh, he doesn't really mean that. And so I really wanted to dig into, does he or does he not mean mm-hmm. what he says? And so that kind of was my launching point cool. for my paper.
And did that seminar paper turn into your writing sample?
It did. Yes. Great.
And did you, part of the kind of, for me, one of the most helpful things when I did my writing sample was having someone else read it. So you probably would have turned in your writing sample shortly after getting some feedback mm-hmm. from the professor of that independent study. Any other kinds of like people were, do you have any other folks looking at that, other mentors or other students?
Yeah, I had a few of my friends read it in between class and then these deadlines. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, my mentor, who was also the professor that I was working with on the paper, gave me good feedback along the way.
Yeah.
And just helped stimulate discussion and conversation about that, and helped me be able to also articulate in conversation with professors that I was networking with to apply how to talk about this topic and show that I'm excited about it, that I'm open to other ideas, but also think that I have maybe a viable research topic.
Yeah. And networking with professors in the departments that you were applying to, tell us a little bit about how you approached that.
Yeah, that is what I feel was one of the most important things for me in just discerning which program was a good fit, mm-hmm. Who I would like to work with, and even meeting with students and seeing how they enjoy the program. I've been to SBL twice. Mm-hmm. The first time I just soaked it all in, enjoyed all the papers, and was like, okay, I need to do this because I love being here.
Yeah.
The second year was all devoted to meeting people and still reading and going to some papers, but mostly trying to meet professors and students in programs that I was applying to and hearing a little bit more about if they would be mm-hmm. interested in working with me. Of course, it depends on what kind of program you're applying to, if it's in the UK or the States. And but I pretty much narrowed down my programs by finding professors that I was interested in working with and applying to those schools.
Smart. And about how many schools did you end up applying to?
Five or six.
Great. Mm-hmm. And processing with you here. Another one of the things that I found so difficult was the period between submitting applications and hearing anything back. Mine was a pretty gaping chasm because I submitted early. I think I sent everything in December 1st to all of the programs, then didn't hear anything back until January, obviously, since there's mm-hmm. the Christmas holiday and things. But how did you negotiate that? Or are you just a superhero who gets to those things without thinking about them?
No, I'm not a superhero.
Cool.
I definitely thought about them before I submitted them, but I think I had staggered deadlines, which helped because I was still focused on other things after I submitted my first few applications. And then I think I just slept through Christmas break and forgot about it all. Yeah. But no, there's definitely that anxiety in the waiting period and like, am I going to get in? Am I worth it? I don't know.
Right.
But I think if you just approach it that like you've put your best foot forward, you've worked hard, like not everyone's going to get in. There's not enough spots for everyone. And if you have the tenacity to try again, like, do that. But there's also something about like having imposter syndrome that makes you not take it for granted when you do get in, or when you are applying and just waiting, you feel this sense of gratitude toward just the opportunity to hopefully do it. But
yeah, for sure. Okay. Any final tips or pieces of wisdom that you feel like you earned that you really need to tell our listeners who are thinking about applying or actively are trying to apply?
Yeah. My best piece of advice would be that there is a temptation for these applications and for academia in general to consume you, and find friends who are not in this field. Spend time with family who's also probably not in academia, and also find ways to read literature and poetry and do things that you love that will help keep you grounded, especially in the application process when anxiety is generally heightened.
Yeah. Awesome. Lainey, thank you so much for joining us today.
Yeah. Thank you.
Before we hear from Dr. Cardozo-Orlandi, I want to take a quick break to tell you about a new book from Baylor Press. It's a book by Ryan Andrew Newsom called The End of Civility. I met Ryan this summer at a conference. He's kind, thoughtful, asks great questions. And in this book, he asks a lot of great and difficult questions. He asks what criteria Christians can use to judge between healthy and toxic appeals to civility. He asks what counts as civil in the first place, and why calls for civility sometimes hinder justice. He argues that for Christians, civility can never be an ultimate good, but remains always subordinate to the call to follow Christ, in particular the Christ who is not always civil, but who calls people to an ethic of resistance, to injustice, and solidarity with people who are suffering. Sounds interesting, right? Pick up a copy today, wherever you get books. Okay, now, here is my conversation with Dr. Carlos Cardozo-Orlandi on what makes for a strong application. Dr. Cardozo-Orlandi, thank you for joining us on Currents in Religion.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Really appreciate the invitation.
So you've been here for a while now, and you've also served on the admissions committee for graduate applications. Give us some insight into how Baylor's religion department processes the applicants it gets, the applications it gets for the PhD program. Who evaluates them? How do they get narrowed down? Those sorts of things.
Yes. In terms of the actual decision-making of the applications, the admissions committee has, I would say, a secondary role of basically looking overall and helping each other look at the applications and see if something is missing, if there's any red flag that we need to be aware of. But the major responsibility of decisions in terms of the applicants falls in the responsibility of the areas.
Okay.
So therefore, in my case, the historical area, right now I think we're five members of the faculty who will read those applications and will make recommendations. And basically it's a ranking process.
Okay.
And out of that ranking process, we basically, it's divided, I would say, into those that we like, and we don't rank them in terms of one, two, three, four, but we, those that actually fit the program, those that actually fit what we do, And those that actually do not fit. And those that do not fit, we just keep them, you know, in a different box.
Yeah. So say I've seen a lot on the internet about fit. Describe what you mean by fit, or what your area means by fit in terms of what you do. Yeah.
Yeah. I think that the to talk about fit in an area, and I will only speak about the historical area.
Perfect.
It means, for instance, our area is very strong from early modern Christianity, early modern history, to contemporary history.
Right.
So if we get an application of a student who wants to do antiquity.
Yeah, right.
That applicant will quickly go that down. Yeah. Simply because we don't have the personnel mm-hmm. to actually address the applicant's interest.
Right.
Right?
Right.
On the other hand, if we have an applicant who is very interested in the areas of, let's say, gender mm-hmm. studies and the role of women in interreligious dialogue, that will immediately click with, for instance, Dr. Flowers,
right.
Dr. Whitford, and me.
Right.
See? Also, regions are important. If there's a student, an applicant who wants to consider doing work in Latin America or Sub-Saharan Africa or certain regions of Asia, it would that's a fit.
Right.
So fit is related to who we are mm-hmm. in the area.
Yeah.
What do we do? So a student who is applying to Baylor to any of the four areas, she or he should be very careful to see what the faculty has published, what are their areas of interest, and what are the things that characterize, in general, the area's interest. Because right. sometimes it's not just one area of interest. I don't do gender. But Dr. Flowers does, and Dr. Whitford, they do.
Yeah.
So the combination of interreligious dialogue, which I do, and gender studies fits three of us.
Right. Yeah.
That's a benefit.
That is.
That immediately is an appeal, I would say. Is that helpful?
Yeah, very helpful. So you've mentioned that the admissions committee here at Baylor, at least, serves as kind of quality control is maybe the wrong word, but is looking at the applications as a whole and kind of keeping an eye on big picture things. But the decisions about students, the ranking of students who might get an interview and then their order on the wait list, that's coming from an area's faculty specifically.
Exactly. Yeah, you've got it. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
So from your experience, working through applications with your area, what are some of the things that make applications stand out besides fit? Obviously, fit is incredibly important. That's maybe one of the highest metrics. But what else are you looking for in an application that really makes it leap out from the others?
Yes, that's a really good question. So you're asking me to now move from just the regular fit to a deeper.
Yeah.
What are we looking for? First of all, we're looking for a clear, and succinct personal statement.
Mm-hmm.
And in clarity, what I mean by clarity is, I would say, the best possible personal statement integrates a little bit of the biography of the student or of the applicant with her or his academic interest.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important.
Right.
When I see that, I began to see coherence on the applicant.
Mm-hmm.
And coherence immediately in the academic world, as you can imagine, that's an appeal.
Right.
That's an appeal.
Right.
So I would say that that's very important.
Mm-hmm.
Secondly, this element between, I would call it biography and the area of interest, in addition to be coherent, should demonstrate a query, a question,
right?
An area of interest that is, I wouldn't call it unique because it's too early to make it unique, but I would call it that is an area of interest that makes connections with the area, but also is something that is, I would say, fresh, not new.
Right.
But fresh, brings a new perspective. Second thing I would say that immediately captures my attention is a good research paper.
Hmm.
Let me now give you an example again about how research papers And though, and that statement, that yeah. personal statement, sometimes is there need to be coherence between them. Mm-hmm. I remember reading an application in which this particular applicant was interested in gender relationships or gender constructs mm-hmm. within Muslim and Christian communities in a particular region of Western Africa.
Okay.
It was a very interesting area of interest. The research paper was on Jonathan Edwards.
Oh, interesting.
Now, the research paper was good.
Right.
I mean, I'm not an expert in Jonathan Edwards, but my colleagues said that it was okay.
Right.
But I was unable to see. And in this case, I'm the one who has a little bit more burden.
Right.
Because it's world Christianity.
Right. It's your focus.
It's my focus. Yeah. And the applicant wanted to work with me.
Yeah.
I was unable to see.
Right.
The how has this question that is so interesting mm-hmm. in your personal statement and your question about academic interest, how does it show? How have you shown that you can work with this theme?
Right, right, yeah.
You know, and I would rather have a. I would rather have a above standard paper related to the inquiry than a paper that has nothing to do with it.
Right, sure.
And that because makes sense. I can make a judgment. So that research paper is important. Mm-hmm. The other thing I would say is the letters of recommendation.
Okay.
Those are very important. Again, some applications might be above standard, above average in the statement, the personal statement, even the research paper. But then you've got stellar.
Sure.
Letters of recommendation mm-hmm. from colleagues in the field that actually will not only write a letter of recommendation, they might even send an email to me. And say, I've got a couple of students going your way.
Yeah.
So that, all of that, so certainly begins to create a balance in the overall application.
Yeah.
In order to help the applicant in that sense. So don't if your area of interest is to give just an example, is the history of Christianity in El Congo during the early modern period, mm-hmm. The letters of recommendation should not be from somebody who helped the student or helped the applicant in a contextual, ministerial
right.
Course.
Right.
In a practical area.
Yeah.
That's not going to help.
Right.
I mean, do we know that applicant is a great person and has deep empathy? Yes, and all of that is good, but I cannot assess the research right. abilities through that kind of a letter.
Yeah.
So letters of recommendation should also be strong.
So I've got a couple of questions. This is all great stuff. The first one would be related to that combination of biography and kind of research interest or academic background in the cover letter or the statement. I guess the question mark sometimes for me when I was writing these documents was, how much does a committee want to know about me as a person in a way that doesn't come off as just self-aggrandizing, you know, just trying to make myself sound like the most wonderful person they could have ever possibly met. So I guess help me understand a little bit for you as you're reading along. You know, they don't need to know where you were born and what elementary school you went to and who your best friend was. But what autobiographical stuff are you looking for that kind of helps you better understand the coherence of their research project?
Yes, that's a really good question. And perhaps the best way I could answer is by giving you two examples.
Okay.
I think the examples are very helpful. What is good. Yeah. I remember my own application. Now, that's not a long time ago, but my own application, and I would consider, I only applied to one school.
Wow.
I didn't apply to five or six schools like I would recommend.
Right.
I applied to one because my wife and I talked about it and said, if this doesn't work, we go back to Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
It was as simple as that.
Yeah.
As simple as that. And I remember that my personal statement had to do very much with the question of Latin American Protestant identity.
Mm-hmm.
And in terms of my biography, what I narrate, the narration, the brief paragraph, because you don't have a lot of space.
Right.
The brief paragraph that I wrote was the multiple sources that shape or could shape my Protestant identity as a Caribbean Christian.
Right.
Among them being my interaction with the world of the spirits, which in the Protestant legacy, missionary legacy, that world of the spirits should either be eradicated or demonized.
Right.
But when I articulate the fact that I come from this background that demonizes and eradicates the world of the spirits, but at the same time, my actual experience growing up as an evangelico was with charismatic experience of the spirit.
Yeah.
And then connecting that to the question of Protestant identity and the question of how does this, is this a new element to shape Christian Caribbean identity? And then the discussion of the actual academic stuff.
Right.
That made it for me in the place where I did my PhD.
Yeah. Right.
Because actually, that's what they said. Mm-hmm. That would be one example.
Okay.
Another example comes from an academic inquiry.
Mm-hmm.
I have read very good applications in which an applicant states an experience while doing academic work, an experience that opened up. It just opened up new questions.
Right.
New questions.
Mm-hmm.
So it is biographical because in a way, let's use some academic terms here.
Yeah.
The epistemology has been challenged.
Right.
And now you're asking new questions.
Mm-hmm.
You're raising new questions.
Right.
Music, for instance, the exposition of African music or Afro-Caribbean music, Afro-Caribbean Christian music, has triggered elements about who is Christ, who is God, the role of the scriptures.
Mm-hmm.
But they come from academic inquiry.
Yeah.
So like you said, I'm not interested in knowing who your best friend is. Although if you tell me that your best friend is a priest if in an Afro-Caribbean religion, and that is challenge the applicant's understanding of faith relationship and interreligious dialogue, that would appeal to me.
Right.
You see what I mean?
Yes. So the autobiographical content that most grips you is when the scholarly inquiry that the applicant is proposing is rooted in something that puts that question in more than just an academic sphere for them. There's a motivational tie-in somehow. And in some sense, this could be totally off the mark, but it reminds me of, I think it's an anecdote about Reverend Childs, although I don't know if it's actually from him.
You mean from the professor from Princeton?
Uh-huh.
Yes, I know who you're talking about. Yes.
I've heard this story associated with him where a student came up to him who had constantly gotten B's or something, and they said, Dr. Childs, I feel like I'm doing great work. Could you just tell me how I could get an A in your class? And his response, if he actually said this, was be a more interesting person, which sounds very unkind, but I've often thought of that in my own writing as an invitation to not make questions or research totally abstract. It's embedded in something, in a story that you're currently participating in.
Exacto. Man, you said it better than I did, you know, with that other example. We have right now one of our students in the history area. Her background is of Syriac Orthodox Christianity. Okay. Yet she's Presbyterian.
Mm-hmm.
But she has discovered in media sources of Syriac identity through rituals of the Syriac church that are being done in media for the diaspora Syriac community. When I remember reading her application, she had a successful application. Eh?
Yeah,
that's why she's here.
Yeah.
When that application was read, like you said, you should be a more perhaps Dr. Shah said, you should be a more interesting person. Holy Mother of God, that person was immediately interested.
Yeah. Yeah.
She became, this is, and it suddenly, and you began to see, she was able to articulate why her biography and the biography of her own community is related to academic, transnational migration work.
Yeah.
And as you can imagine, that's what she's thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But those of us who are reading the application, we see even more things
that she
will do and that she has already been doing only in a first semester of academic work.
Yeah.
Do you see the richness that comes? Because it suddenly, it's like an application should be like a letter. That might be too old for this new generation. An application should be a hologram of the person with an emphasis on the brain, ideas, connections of ideas, and biography.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes it makes a big difference.
Yeah, that's
great. At least I want to emphasize here in our area.
Yeah.
That's how I see our area. Maybe my colleagues in other fields are more interested in the language background, although none of that is less important.
Right.
But we're talking, it's high competition, man. Mm-hmm. It's high competition. So you've got to show something.
Right.
You know, and maybe if you speak already, if you can read and speak Hebrew, Greek, Aramaic, Aguarithic, maybe that's the appeal.
Right.
But if you come as a basic student going to Bible with the basic languages, I would imagine that my colleagues are looking for something juicy.
Yeah.
Something that will appeal.
Nice.
Yeah.
I'll have to ask them about that.
Yeah, yeah.
I am going to follow up on one other thing that you mentioned for a strong application. You mentioned personal references, and you made a comment about potentially certain references even reaching out to you with an email. Some students have made such an impression on their professors in their academic past that they might feel compelled to write an email. But I'm imagining many listeners frantically now wondering how they could ask any of their references to send along an email. And I guess I'm curious whether, as a professor of students here, if a student came to you and said, hey, I'm applying for PhD programs, I'd like for you to be a reference, and you agreed to that, would you find it at all strange, or would there be ways to, with good etiquette, ask a reference to maybe reach out on behalf in a more direct way to people in the departments that they're applying to? Or is that something that students, applicants shouldn't ask of their references?
That's a good question, man.
And obviously, so it's case by case, right?
Yes,
I mean,
sometimes
a student will have just developed such a relationship, even a mentor relationship with someone, that question would be the most natural thing. I'm thinking especially of students maybe whose master's education has been online, or instances where they're just having they haven't had the same kinds of opportunities to develop those relationships with faculty. And I guess I'm wondering what your instinct would tell you about students who want to reach out to them but feel a little awkward doing so.
I think that, if the relationship is thin, and the relationship is one that is basically shaped by academic work.
Yeah.
There hasn't been more conversations outside of a paper.
Yeah.
Of a search of, I want to do this paper. To be honest with you, I would find it very odd.
Yeah.
For a student to come and ask me,
would you
write, let's say, one of my colleagues at one of the schools that has a strong World Christianity program, and let her or him know that I'm going to apply. I wouldn't go there.
Yeah.
I wouldn't ask my professor to do it, but I would do it.
Yeah.
In other words, the applicant can take that initiative.
Yeah.
And because PhDs on doctoral programs, some of the best doctoral programs continue to be face-to-face,
yeah.
Then that would allow the applicant to actually connect.
Yeah.
And that may allow for the colleague to then email the other colleague in the other place.
Yeah.
In other words, sometimes the etiquette is not asking your master's faculty, is the applicant engaging with where you want to study and sending that email and perhaps even visiting campus and then mentioning, let's just put a name here. I did my master's degree at X school, and I enjoyed having class with him. And so I want to, I would like to do the PhD. Then maybe after that conversation, the student leave, and I may actually call so-and-so, who is my colleague and friend, and say, I just had one of your students, because that happens.
Yeah. Right.
That's what the academic networks, that's what happens.
Yep.
So I may actually call my colleague and say, I just got one of your students here. Mm-hmm. And then that generates something that is going on.
Yeah, yeah.
So I would say it's an indirect way
of
making those connections.
Yeah, that's great.
But to be honest with you, in your specific question, if there's no depth of relationship, and by depth I mean just more than just talking about papers, I wouldn't do it.
Yeah, that makes good sense.
I would think the student's think you say in English, presumptuous.
Ah, mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And a presumption characteristic is not a good one.
Right, right. So since we are talking about things we wouldn't do, let's turn to the question of what makes an application kind of sink to the bottom. If the first question was what makes it leap out to you, which one makes it fall down and not be as great as it could be?
Yeah. Well, nowadays, with the digital processes and Interfolio and all of that, one of the good things is that we know which application is completed and which is not.
Yeah.
In the old times, that tells you already how old I am. In the old times, I would have to look at it and look at it almost completely before I recognized that there was something missing.
Right.
So an incomplete application is the terrible thing. But that's being screened out. Or at least when we look at Interfolio here at Baylor, we see when it is completed and when it is not completed.
Right.
So we can make priorities. Having said that, I have identified, I think there are two things, or three things that I would say. Let's go back to that personal statement.
Yes.
Let's say that I want to study with one of my colleagues here in the historical area, and I just say, I just love Luther, or I just love Kwame Bediako, or I just love Ivonne Guevara, and I just want to study them and read more with them, guided by so-and-so. That's not gonna make it, man.
Mm-hmm.
That's not gonna take you anywhere, because I've got three sons. Three. They're not doing religion. They're not doing theology. They're not doing. But they would be willing to read a book on Ivonne Guevara and sit down with me and have a conversation about Latin American feminists.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that they're good to do a PhD.
Right. Right.
So general statements, thin statements, no sense of inquiry.
Yeah.
No sense of intellectual curiosity. Mm-hmm. That's a no-no.
Yeah.
So actually, if there is no intellectual curiosity in the personal statement, don't even send it.
Yeah.
You're wasting 75, 100, 125 bucks, whatever it is. I don't know.
Yeah.
Don't even send it. Secondly, typos in your research paper or typos in your personal statement.
Yeah.
I mean, that's horrible. I mean, we are making, you know, admissions committees, we're making decisions regarding people's future's life, people's, you know, what they, a sense of vocation that they have. If that sense of vocation is so thin that you're willing to send a piece of crap as a research paper, it is not going anywhere.
Right.
At least for me.
Right. And I mean, you mentioned earlier just the sheer competition of many of these programs.
Yes.
It might just come down to who paid more attention, in some cases, to who paid more attention.
Yeah.
On details.
On details.
Things, which is difficult, but it's true.
Yeah. And sometimes I have done it. I began reading a research. First paper, I found four typos. Second page, four typos. That's it.
Yeah.
I don't keep on reading.
Yeah.
I don't keep on reading.
Yeah.
I'm being very honest here to the audience.
Yeah.
And what do I put? I put that application. I put it low.
Yeah.
Very, very low.
Right.
Very. And you know, so and it could have stellar letters of recommendation, but you see, I didn't get to them.
Right.
That is where having the whole area, because maybe somebody from the area who is not that much interested in typos might be reading the letters of recommendation, and my colleague might say, did you read the letters of recommendation? And then I may go back.
Right.
But I'm going to come back to my colleague and say, did you notice how awful the writing was?
Right. Right.
So do we want to do remedial work? You know?
Yeah.
And let me tell you, for international students, so I was an international student where I did my PhD. And I had my work edited.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work, man.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. I started by writing in Spanish, translating to English. It was a lot of work.
Yeah.
It was a lot of work. But it paid off.
Right. Right.
It's paid off. It's worth it. Obviously, because I was investing in my vocation.
Yeah.
Which now has been 30 plus years. You see? So I think it's important. And for international students to get their work edited before is important. Most of us, at least I think that at my age and with my experience, I can actually read in English and see when this was originally written in Spanish or this was originally written in Portuguese.
Yeah.
Maybe other languages I can't do, but I can pick it up, but I can see the work invested.
Right.
And that's I appreciate it.
That's a big deal.
I appreciate it. I do appreciate it very much.
Great.
Yeah. And those were the things I would
so
say.
Finish your application.
Yep.
Be specific and show intellectual curiosity.
Yes.
And edit your work.
Yes.
Edit, and do more edits.
Yes, and do more.
Yeah.
And the other thing I would say, this is a fourth one, is, I just want to study with Dr. Betsy Flowers and Dr. I'm a Baptist, and I want to study with Dr. Betsy Flowers, and I want to study with Dr. Doug Weaver. Well, what do you want to study with them?
Right.
And then why do you want to study with them?
Yeah.
Those are two importants. So what do you want to study and why do you want to study?
Great. Dr. Cardoza Orlandi, thank you so much for your time. We're going to have to call it here. And I hope that you have fun reading applications when they come in later this fall and early winter.
Yes, thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks again to all of our guests for joining us. And thank you for listening. I hope you found this episode helpful as you work on your own applications or consider applying for PhD programs. If you're in that process, I'm happy to talk more with you. Send me an email at zen_hess1@baylor.edu. If you did find this episode helpful, share it with folks who might find it helpful too. Subscribe to keep up with future episodes and leave us a review so we know how we're doing. Next week, we're speaking with Neil Messer, a theological bioethicist and a new faculty member here at Baylor. Until then, take care.